start, and I'm talking today about aggregation kinetics. So the rest of these lectures, instead of being primarily motivated by mathematical questions, are going to be motivated by physics problems, so aggregation kinetics. So the cartoon that I have in mind, what I'm going to spend my time studying, is I have clusters, and they just irreversibly meet and stick together. So pictorially, I have a cluster of mass I and a cluster of mass j, and they come together. And with some reaction rate, kij, they will convert into some bigger object of mass I plus j. And so that'll be called little k. So that's all there is to aggregation kinetics. I just have a population of clusters, and they continue to aggregate and grow. And we'd like to understand the cluster mass distribution. So the basic question here, Ck of t equals question mark. And so this is defined to be the concentration of clusters of mass k at time t. Maybe this is below the line. Can you guys see this down here? No. All right, I just stopped. Concentration of clusters of mass k at time t. So if you want to have specific things to think about the aggregation of planetesimals to make planets. You know, you start with matter in the universe, and it accretes by gravitational accretion, and you can build up planets, stars, et cetera. Or you can think about water vapor in the atmosphere, in which water vapor condenses into droplets, and the droplets condense into larger droplets, and eventually get rain. Or again, you make jello dessert, where you pour in jello powder into water and you mix it up. And at the end of the day, you get a semi-solid gel molecule. And so all of these are examples of aggregation kinetics. And so we'd like to understand the kinetics of this process. So this example I'm going to be describing to you now is one of the first applications of the so-called master equation approach, for which by the end of the next week, hopefully you'll have seen it enough times, you'll say, oh, it's all old hat. But at this stage, I'm assuming that most of you have never seen this kind of formulation, so I'll be gentle at the very beginning about this. OK, so let me now write down the so-called master equations, which describe the evolution of the cluster mass distribution. So the idea here is he'd like to say that our basic observables are these quantities Ck. And as time evolves, because there's aggregation, the concentration of clusters of mass K will evolve with time. So the master equation is an equation for how this thing changes with time. And how can this concentration change? There are two basic ways that the concentration can change. You can either create new clusters of mass K because you aggregate two smaller clusters whose mass adds up to k, or you can destroy clusters of mass k because a k can interact with something else to make something even larger still. So these two terms, so let me now write it down, and then I'll explain in more detail. I'll write this as 1/2 summation I plus j equals k, k I j c I c j, minus c k summation over all I equals 1 to infinity, k I k c I. So that is called the master equation. And so as advertised, the first term here is describing a gain, because it's coming with a plus sign, so it's increasing c k. And this is the loss term, because it comes with a minus sign. And let's dissect this equation, because the crucial thing is just understanding the meaning of this equation. Everything else that follows from this is fairly just turning some crank. So what's happening here is that how can Ck increase? Well, if I have a cluster of mass I and mass j, if they come together with a rate kij, just as in this cartoon, I'll create k. So here's the rate at which I and j react, ci, cj. So the thing is that in a, yeah, question.
Are they integers, or are they just arbitrary
masses? Well, for this discussion, let's take them to be integers. So I'm imagining that I start with a system of unit mass monomers, and so I'm always building integers. But in principle, we could have continuous masses here as well. So again, if I imagine a well-mixed system, then the probability that a cluster of mass I and a cluster of mass j will meet is just proportional to the product of their concentrations. So that is why there's this factor ci, cj here. And then kij times this will be then, so this is the probability that two clusters of mass I and mass j will meet. Kij is the reaction rate, as written over here, that will then convert the I plus j into a k-mer of total mass I plus j. And then I have to sum up over all possible combinations of I plus j that add up to k. Then the other thing is, notice there's a 1/2 out in front, which is meant to prevent overcounting, because if I want to create clusters of mass 17, I could have 2 and 15 or 15 and 2. And because there's two different ways of creating 2 and 15, either I is 2 and j is 15 or vice versa, I have to put a factor 1/2 out in front. So the first term here is describing all the possible combinations of adding up to k, and so it's the gain term. And similarly, for the loss term, in order to kill off a k-mer, so the technical term is k-mer, like you have polymer, and so when a polymer has mass k, you can call it a k-mer. So anyways, a k-mer is lost whenever it interacts with anybody else. So I have to sum up over the masses of any other interaction partner, and the probability that an I and a k meet is ci, ck, and then times the reaction rate, which is the probability that when they actually meet, they're converted to a cluster of mass I plus k. And this will then contribute to the loss of the probability of having a cluster of mass k. So this is the master equation. And again, let me stop here and just ask any questions you want about the form of this equation. Because once you buy this, then everything else is going to follow straightforwardly. Yes?
So clustering occurs at sort of the negative rate of breaking apart, right?
There's no breaking apart here. There's only irreversible. So let me maybe add one more word here. Irreversible. We could also allow breakup to occur, and that's a richer problem. And you know, once you know how to do irreversible aggregation kinetics, you'll have the tools to worry about reversible. Yes?
I still haven't understood the second term, if you could explain it again, please.
OK, the second term. So again, first of all, notice the minus signs. That means we're losing clusters of mass k. So how can we lose a cluster of mass k? We lose clusters of mass k if a k is sitting here, and somebody else comes in and interacts with it, say this is I, and then we make a cluster of mass, total mass k plus I. So we start with a cluster of mass k and a cluster of mass I, and at the end of the day, we've lost one cluster of mass k. So when k meets an I-mer, that's a way of killing off k-mer, and so the rate at which k-mer is killed is proportional to the concentration of clusters of mass k times the concentration of clusters of any other mass, and then this interaction rate is telling me the rate at which k and an I meet and actually are converted to something heavier.
There's no sort of breaking up possible around.
You are, again, only talking about irreversible aggregation. And again, once you're used to these equations, you can do it as an exercise for yourself to allow the possibility that breakup can occur as well. And then you would have two more terms, because you could create clusters of mass k by having something heavier have something break and make a k, and similarly you could have loss. excuse me. So you'd have two more terms in the equation. Anything else? Yes.
So the whole formula that we're building, we're right away setting that the only thing that's going to change your reaction rate is just the mass of the two particles.
That's right.
Interacting. Whereas you could imagine that in practice would rather be like position and velocity and stuff like that.
Okay.
Mass would actually be very small role.
Well, okay, so your comment leads me now to, let's spend some time talking about the assumptions of this whole master equation approach, because you've raised a very good point. So let me mention some of these assumptions. The first one here is that there's no space, no spatial degrees of freedom. That is that I have C k of t, not C k of x comma t. There's no spatial position here. If I really wanted to have a full description of the process, I'd want to know what is the concentration of clusters of mass k at time t at a particular spatial position. There's no space here. So what I'm kind of assuming is that my system is thoroughly mixed at all times so that the local concentration is the same as the global concentration, and so there's no spatial degrees of freedom. So that's one important point. Another important thing here is that I'm only assuming two-body interactions. So there's never a possibility that three clusters can come together simultaneously. You know, I can't have one 17 and three coming together to make a cluster of mass 21. It's only two-body interactions. So this would be appropriate in the dilute limit. Another important feature of this is that there's no shape. The only characteristic of a cluster is its total mass, not anything to do with the shape. So if you want to have a specific picture, then you can think of these as like spherical droplets. And so whenever two spherical droplets come together and merge, surface tension forces them to remain spherical. So the only degree of freedom then is the mass and nothing else. So no shape is allowed in this. And the other thing which I'm assuming here is the thermodynamic limit. That is that the total number of clusters is going to infinity. So that instead of talking about the number of clusters, I'm talking about a smooth concentration, which varies smoothly. I mean, you could imagine that if I have a finite system, I could have, just by bad luck, no clusters of mass 17 lying around. But in a master equation approach, the concentration of clusters will be perfectly smooth. And even if the concentration is much less than 1, you still have a continuous value for it. And so that's buried, that's inside of this assumption of the thermodynamic limit. So here is the approach. Here is the general formalism. And now I want to solve these master equations. And in order to solve them, we have to make some assumption about the form of the reaction rate. So let me now discuss the reaction rate. So at the end of last lecture, I spent some time discussing the reaction rate. And we showed how in three dimensions, or at least above two dimensions, the reaction rate was a finite constant. And we learned from last time that K was proportional to D, the diffusion coefficient, times the radius of the object to the D minus 2 power. That was from last time. And so what this reaction rate was referring to was a situation where I had one sphere of radius r, and then there was a gas of diffusing particles that were perfectly absorbed whenever they hit the sphere. Now, for aggregation kinetics, what I have is not just one sphere which perfectly that stays there forever and just absorbs everything else around it, but I have aggregates that are mutually killing each other off, because whenever two guys meet, an I and a j will both be killed off, and I'll create something with mass I plus j. So in this aggregation process, then the relevant radius is not the radius of a single cluster, but the probability that the two molecules will actually hit each other is proportional to the sum of the radii, ri plus rj to the d minus 2 power. And I left some space here, because now I've got to ask what happens for this diffusion coefficient. So the thing is that the classic example that I worked out last time, the so-called Smoluchowski rate theory, was based on one particle at rest and everybody else having the same diffusion coefficient. But now, if I'm having a gas of polymers, all of different masses, each polymer will have its own diffusion coefficient that depends on its mass. And the appropriate generalization of the diffusion coefficient in a rest frame of a static particle is just the summation of the diffusion coefficients of the two constituent particles. Next point is that if I'm going to now live in three dimensions, and let's talk only for three dimensions for everything else that follows, then the radius is proportional to I to the power 1/3 plus j to the power 1/3. And then the diffusion coefficient. And now here I'm going to take something which I assume that you've never seen before, and but let's hopefully you'll buy it as reasonable, which is that what is the diffusion coefficient of an object? Well, if I'm thinking about polymers diffusing around in a solution, there's something called the Stokes-Einstein relation, which tells us that the diffusion coefficient is proportional to the inverse mass. The heavier a particle is, the slower it's going to diffuse. I hope that is reasonable by itself. And how much slower it diffuses turns out to be proportional to the inverse, I'm sorry, the inverse radius, not the inverse mass. So this thing is proportional to I to the minus 1/3 plus j to the minus 1/3. If you want me to derive this, I can do this maybe at another time, but you know, it involves things that I'm assuming you've never seen before. So I'm just take this as a plausibility argument. Anyways, if you take this, then what we get when we multiply this out is that there's 2 plus I over j to the 1/3 plus j over I to the 1/3. Now, if I'm thinking about a process where clusters are aggregating, and so clusters are always getting continuously larger, then the typical value of I and the typical value of j are both increasing. And what I'm going to do in order to come up with a model that we can solve explicitly is let's just take these terms to be both order one. And so for the purposes of this discussion, I hope this motivates, let's take the case, the simplifying case, Kij is equal to 2. I'm just going to assume that all reaction rates are the same. Obviously, in this equation, taking constant reaction rates is a very simple, it's the simplest thing you can assume. And here's an attempt to try and justify it in the framework of Brownian particles, diffusing particles in solution. So the reaction rate is 2 plus corrections, which if the masses are typically the same size, then these corrections are order 1. And so it motivates having a constant reaction rate. Yes?
Is it very obvious the way you're doing it?
Is what very obvious? Nothing
is obvious. The generalization to be equal to 3 and then using the radius.
Well, I mean, this is what I derived yesterday.
Right.
And then I'm just saying that I hope this line is semi-obvious, because I'm just saying that if I now have many particles that are all reactive, that the relative distance, the separation at which two particles react is the sum of their radii.
Sure.
And the relative diffusion coefficient is the sum of the diffusion coefficients. Then to go from here to here, I'm just taking d equals 3. And then this part is, I'm saying, this I assume you don't know. And so this part's not obvious. I hope this part is still obvious.
Okay, the first part is not obvious.
This one, di plus dj.
And then how would we relate it to?
OK, so the thing is, I'll come to you in a second. So the point is that, you know, think about two diffusing particles. So, you know, let's draw here on space, and here let's draw time. And I have two particles which are diffusing like this. And so here's their space-time trajectory. If I go to the rest, so here I have a diffusion coefficient d and a diffusion coefficient d. If I go into the rest frame of one particle, so let's now say, let's move in the rest frame of this particle. So in this frame, it's just doing that. I can ask, what is the effective diffusion coefficient of the other guy? This guy will turn out to be twice d. And roughly speaking, the point is that you know, you can think about the diffusion coefficient as the hopping rate. And so if I force this guy to stay still, you know, the point is that whenever this guy hops, this guy also, you know, when this guy moves this way by one step, even if this guy is static, in the rest frame of this guy, it looks like it's moving. So if I go to the rest frame of one of the particles, this guy is hopping at twice the rate. And so that's where the summation of the diffusion coefficients comes in here.
So we associated the hopping without any sense of direction to it.
Correct. That's right, because it's isotropic. So it's just a measure of like how often you hop. So, you know, a way to think about this is that instead of thinking about random, discrete time random walks in which you hop one step to the left or hop one step to the right, think about that you just have a continuous rate. At some continuous rate, you just hop by some random direction by a fixed amount. So if both of these guys have the same hopping rate, then if I force this guy to be at rest, this guy's going to have an effective rate of just twice as much. Because whenever this guy hops, this one will see him hop. But whenever this guy had hopped, this guy will also hop. And so there's twice the rate.
Right. But since the directions are totally random, I mean, if I were to intuitively think about it, it could be, for example, the arithmetic mean of the two diffusion constant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wouldn't be obvious to me why it should just be the simple addition of the two.
Yeah, and so all
that
I'm
is my question.
Yeah, OK. And so again, what I'm trying to say is that if I have a rate r of hopping and a rate r of hopping here. So whenever, you know, so let me draw it the following way. So here's a trajectory, and if there's a hopping, then this happens. Like I just hop by the plus or minus one. So here's my trajectory in this sort of continuous time process. Whenever I hop, you know, this is proportional to one over the rate, the time between hops. And similarly, this guy is doing the same kind of thing. And so sometimes there might be a long distance between hops, sometimes a short distance between hops, but this typical time is 1 over r. Now I go into this rest frame, and then you ask how often this particle will look like it hops. So whenever this guy hopped, so first of all, in the rest frame of this guy first hopped, and so we went away. But then very soon afterwards, it came back because this guy hopped. And so the rate of these little jigs and jags for the composite particle is twice as many because every single one of these events corresponds to this effective particle hopping. So if the rate here was r and the rate here was r, the rate of these of this distance separation between the two particles hopping is twice r. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Okay, you had a question.
I was just going to ask, if you're saying that I over j to the 1/3 plus j over I to the 1/3 is an order 1, why don't we write kij as 3?
Okay, it doesn't matter because the reason I'm choosing 2 here is just for convenience. But
okay,
we
so
could
the
write
fact
it.
That it's constant.
Constant. No, that's, okay. That's the main point. Or maybe I should have written 4. Anything else before I go on? Okay. So let's now deal with the case kij equals 2. All right, so let me write out the equations. So for kij equals 2, so my rate equations are ck dot is equal to summation over I and j adding up to k, and then I have ci cj minus ck 2 ck sum ci. So those are my equations. Now let's get a feeling for them. Let me just write them out one by one. So c1 dot. How does the number of monomers, or the concentration of monomers, disappear? If the monomers is the smallest elemental unit, then I can never create monomers. They only can get removed. And so this is equal to minus 2 ck sum ci, I equals 1 to infinity. Because this total concentration appears over and over again, and since I'm generally lazy, let me write this as minus 2 ck times n, which is the number density of all clusters. C2 dot. So from here, we're going to get a C1 squared. That's the way that we can create dimers. We have two monomers come together, they meet, and they react. And I have minus 2 C2n. C3 dot. So I have C1, C2. But C2, C1, so there's two of these guys. So I'll have 2 C1, C2 minus 2 C3, n. C4 dot. Well, I can have C1, C3, or C3, C1. So I'll have 2 C1, C3 plus C2 squared minus 2 C4, n. Let me just do one more, C5 dot. Here I'll have 2 C1, C4. Plus 2 C2 C3 minus 2 C5 N. And so you can write these down one by one. Question? Thank you. Sorry. Minus 2 C1, 2 C1. Thank you very much. So those are the equations. So if we can solve these equations, we'll be golden. Now, the thing about these equations, first of all, is that they are of a recursive structure. And in many body physics, there's two types of equations that rise when you're dealing with many body problems, so-called hierarchical equations and recursive. What I mean by recursive is that, so let me just write recursive, that if I could solve for C1, then the equation for C2 involves only C1, so I could solve for C2. And then C3 involves only 1 and 2, so I can solve for C3, and so on down the road. So if you can solve the first of them, you can solve all of them one by one. And these are called recursive equations. In many body physics problems, however, many types of equations are hierarchical, in which instead of the equation for CK involving lower order, they involve higher order. So you have to solve for everything at once, and you can never do that. So a nice feature about these equations is that they're recursive. And as we'll see, they're completely soluble. Now, the thing is that I will show you how to solve the, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. So, okay, so if I could solve for n, and then I could do this recursively. And as I'm going to show you now, we can solve for n. So the thing about these equations that it's it takes some time to get a feeling for what's the meaning of these equations. And so before I try and solve them like by a frontal attack, let's say let's try and do something else. Let's look at the moments of the cluster size distribution. And the moments, so let me define m sub n. I'll make the definition of k to the power n ck, the nth moment of the distribution. And so this sum goes from k equals 1 to infinity. So in particular, m0, which is equal to summation ck, also has the name of little n. M1, for example, is summation k ck. What is this guy? So this is the concentration of clusters of mass k times k. This is nothing more than the total mass in the system, which I can fix to be anything I want. So I'm going to fix this thing to be 1. And so then next is m2, which is summation k squared ck, and so on down the road. So the thing is that, you know, when you're trying to calculate a statistical distribution, oftentimes it's hard. Like, for example, think about the good old random walk. Probably, you know, in one line, you learn how to compute the mean square displacement of a random walk. But then you have to work a lot harder to calculate the Gaussian probability distribution function. And when you guys are undergraduates, you know, when you're in some, you know, you're in a class and you take a test, you always ask, what was the average? What was the average? You didn't really care about the distribution of the grades unless there was some guy out at the tails that you wanted to murder because he, like, you know, screwed up the average. So the thing is that the full distribution contains everything, but if you can't get everything at the first shot, it's very natural to begin by computing low-order moments. So let's do the calculation of low-order moments just to get a feeling for how we might attack the problem in general. So let's look at the equation for m0 dot, first of all. So this is, how do I calculate this thing? I have to take my master equation here, and so I have to take summation ck dot times k to the power 0. So to calculate the zeroth moment, I have to take these equations and just add them all up. So let's do that. So this is equal to, so summation k equals 1 to infinity. This is equal to summation k equals 1 to infinity times summation ij ci cj minus 2 ck, and let's just put here n. Let's call it now m0 since we're talking about the moments. So let's see what this equation does. So first point is that this first summation was a constrained sum because we had to have that I plus j added up to k. But now we do a second summation over all k. And the effect of that second summation is that it unconstrains the sum so that this thing now becomes nothing more than two independent summations, I and j, independent ci, cj. And so this is nothing more than just m0 quantity squared. And here, when I sum this over all k, I get 2m0 and then times summation ck, which is precisely m0 again. So the first term gives me just a factor of m0 squared. This gives me minus 2m0 squared. So the answer here is equal to minus 2m0 squared. So we found the zeroth moment of the distribution. We therefore have found that m0 is dot is equal to minus 2 minus, sorry, there's no 2 here, because I had m0 squared from here minus 2m0 squared, so the answer is minus 1m0 squared. So the equation is minus m0 squared, and the solution to this is m0 is equal to 1 over 1 plus t. That's the solution to this equation. So we found how the total number of clusters decays with time. It decays in time as 1 over t. So if I start with a collection of monomers, because they're always aggregating together, the number of clusters is obviously decreasing monotonically with time. And this is telling us how quickly it's decreasing with time. once we found the zeroth moment, hopefully now we kind of begin to see the game for in general. So instead of looking at the moments one by one, let me write an equation for the nth moment in general. Yes?
How did you make the now independent CICJ sum go away?
Well, the thing is that so this is equal to summation CI summation CJ. And by definition, this is nothing more than M0. And this is another M0, so it's M0 squared.
Got it. That also explains my next question, where the coefficient 2 go.
Yeah, OK, that's where it went. OK, so let's now, excuse me. Let me now do the same thing, but let's do it for the nth moment. So mn dot. So this would be equal to k to the power n ck dot. And so let's write that guy out. And so I erase this because I'm just going to put the same thing back again. So I have the summation k equals 1 to infinity. And so I have k to the n. So for the gain term, it behooves us to write k is equal to I plus j to the power n. And then I have summation. I got to put the other summation here. So I have a summation I and j. And then I have I plus j to the power n ci cj. So that's the gain term. And then I have minus twice summation k to the n ck summation ci. And so you see that on the right-hand side, this part of the equation, what is this? This is nothing more than minus 2 m sub n, m sub 0. So part of the equation for the nth moment is simple. And now we have to deal with this guy. And so it depends now. For every single n, we get a slightly different answer. And so let me just write this. Mn dot is equal to summation. So it's I plus j to the power n ci cj summed over I and j, now independent of each other. Because when I take, again, the sum over all k, this restricted sum, and you know, maybe just be really careful here. Let me maybe put a prime. Wherever the sum was restricted, I'll put a prime to denote that it was restricted, I plus j equals k. So here, this was a restricted sum. But at this point, it becomes now an unrestricted sum. So let's write these out one by one. So m0 dot. So for n zero, when n is 0 here, we forget about this. We have sum ci, sum cj, which is m0 squared. Here we have minus 2 m0 squared. So we get minus m0 squared. M1 dot, how does this vary with time? So for m1, we have I plus j. And now there's two identical terms. We have ici times cj. But ici is m1, and cj is m0. So we get m1, m0 from one term, and another term, m1, m0. So we're going to get twice m1, m0. But the loss term is twice m1, m0. And so it's equal to 0. So this is the statement of mass conservation. And in fact, these sorts of statements are very useful checks that your algebra is correct. You'd like to have the total mass of the system is conserved, and indeed it is conserved. And finally, let's look at m2 dot. So if I put here I plus j quantity squared, so there'll be a term I squared ci cj, which is m2 m0. And then there'll be another identical term, j squared ci cj, which will be, again, m2 m0. So there's twice m2 m0. But then the cross term is ij with a 2, 2 ij ci cj, which is twice m1 times m1. So plus 2m1 squared minus twice m2 m0. And so these guys cancel, and I get twice m1 squared. But the total mass is conserved. And if I choose my initial mass to be 1, then the total mass always remains 1, which means that m2 is going to grow linearly with time. So from this one, we find that m2 is equal to 1 plus 2t. And so we see that the average, the second moment of the mass distribution grows linearly with time. And this is a measure of the average cluster size. And so we can continue the same line of reasoning, calculate all the moments as you want. But what I want to turn my attention now is how we actually solve the system of master equations. Yes, ask away. Because I'm free to choose what I want. So I'm going to choose my initial value to have that the system is, that the total concentration of monomers is set to be 1. So my initial condition is always here, Ck at t equals 0 is equal to delta k1. And I'm free to choose that as I like.
And for N2 also?
Well, the thing is that if this is what my initial condition is, then if I want to compute the initial second moment, I'd have to sum over all k, k squared sum Ck, and that would be also give you 1. Yes.
I'm a little bit confused with how this, because now we're talking about the sum of an infinite number of clusters, mm-hmm. this mass is 1, mm-hmm. when we multiply it by the concentration. And so a little confused about higher C scales, like C2 would then be bound at a half for mass conservation, or?
No, I mean, you could have, like, you could imagine a pathological situation that all monomers became dimers and the process stopped. So at the end of the day, you'd have the concentration of dimers was 1. And everybody okay. else would be 0. So there's no a priori limit on what any of the CK ought to be, except they all have to be less than 1.
Well, no, that's yeah. what I was asking.
Yes.
Do they have to be less than 1 or less than 1 over the mass?
Yeah, no, they have to be less than 1. That's the only obvious constraint you can make. Yes?
I think that if you want to keep the mass conservation, the CK has to be less than 1 over K. Because it's not really the concentration of K merge. Well, it is the concentration of K merge. Mm-hmm. You can't have 1 as the concentration of k-mers. You don't have enough monomers to make this many k-mers.
Ah, I see. Okay. Very good point. Okay. Very, very good point. So if I had start with n monomers and they all stop to dimers, then I have n over 2 dimers. So the final concentration would be like 1 over. Okay. So very good point. I didn't think of that. Okay. All right. Well, now let's go and try and solve these master equations. And there's, in my notes, I show you many different ways of doing so. And I'm going to only do the very first way and the very last way. So let's now solve for CK. So the pedestrian way is just to solve these equations one by one. We now know what N is. So our equation is C1 dot, for example, is equal to minus 2 C1. But N is equal to 1 plus 1 over T. So in principle, this is a soluble equation. The solution to this equation, and here now, whenever I come with an elementary differential equation, I'm not going to go through the details of how you solve it. I'll assume that you can, you know, fiddle with it yourself and figure it out. And so the answer here is this is equal to C1 is equal to 1 over 1 plus t squared. And then C2 dot is equal to, so we have C1 squared. Since we found C1, so I can write this. Sorry. It's 1 over 1 plus t all squared. So C2 dot is equal to C1 squared minus 2 C2, 1 over 1 plus t. And again, C1 we know now, because we found it over here. So we have a simple differential equation for C2. And at the end of the day, what you're going to find here is that C2 is equal to 1 over 1 plus t all squared divided by times t divided by 1 plus t. That's the answer. And then C3 dot equals 2C1C2 minus 2C3 over 1 plus t. We found C1. We found C2. So we have a differential equation for C3. We solve it. And we get, at the end of the day, C3 is equal to 1 over 1 plus t squared, t over 1 plus t squared. And so on down the road. Nobody in the right mind would want to solve the entire system of equations one by one, tedious. That's really the wrong way to do it. So let's say this is the direct way. The direct way and the hopeless way. And what I want to show now is the generating function method, because it is so powerful, and it really gets at the heart of the matter. And so let me introduce to you now the generating function method. And this is kind of the beginning of where a really cool technique in many body physics. So the thing about the generating function method is that notice the original master equation, its form. We have I plus j. So let me write explicitly here. I plus j is equal to k. And as I've mentioned, I guess last time or the time before, this is a form of a convolution. When the two arguments add up to k, that's what's called the convolution. And whenever you see convolution in your undergraduate courses in mathematical physics, you learn that you should Fourier transform when you had convolution in infinite space. Here, the convolution only exists for positive integers. So if it was positive half space, you'd say, I do Laplace transform. But if it's now discrete integers, instead of doing Laplace transform, you do the generating function. The generating function is nothing more than the Laplace transform defined on a discrete set of integer-valued masses. So let me write down the generating function. Let's call it C of z. So this will be defined as a summation ck z to the power k, k equals 1 to infinity. And as written, it encodes, if we could solve for the generating function, then in principle, we can extract every single ck by finding the nth term in the power series representation of this thing. So again, notice that this is like a Laplace transform. If I went from a discrete sum to a continuous integral and I changed z, so somehow it looks a little bit like a summation, an integral over all k, ck, e to the minus s, e to the minus, ks. Where here I define like s is equal to minus log of z. So morally, this is nothing more than the Laplace transform. So I want to now use this generating function technique. And as you're going to see, it's a very spectacular method because what it does is it takes this infinite set of equations and reduces it to a single equation that we can solve immediately and then extract the full cluster mass distribution. So how do we apply the generating function? So I take my master equation, ck dot is equal to summation prime. Ci cj minus unconstrained sum 2 ck sum ci. So there is my initial master equation. And what I'm going to do now is that I multiply the whole thing by power z to the power k and sum it from k equals 1 to infinity. And let's see what happens when I do all of that stuff. So, yes?
Why are we summing up ck dot if we're trying to find c? We defined it in terms of ck.
Yeah, well, so the thing is that the initial master equation is an equation that tells us how the concentrations vary with time. It's a differential equation. What I'm going to now do is find how the generating function varies in time. And instead of having an infinite series of equations for how ck dot evolves, I'm just going to get a single equation for how ck evolves.
So term by term differentiation, z doesn't depend on time, so it's just...
Right. I mean, well, the thing is that each one of the, ck of t is time dependent. So
no,
this
I mean,
thing, this
no,
thing,
curly.
Yeah, curly c has time inside of it because, so let me be pedantic for a moment. This is ck of t, z to the power k. So each one of the cluster masses, each one of the cluster concentrations is time dependent. So therefore, the total generating function is also time dependent. But I typically don't write it just to avoid writing lots of junk.
But so z is not
time right. dependent. Right. Z is just some parameter here.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. Okay, so anyways, on the left-hand side, we just have c dot. Because we just have ck, zk, time derivative. So we have c dot. The first term on the right. So here comes a nice little trick, which is I have summation, sum ci, cj. The sum over all k makes these two sums now independent. And here on this side, I can write k as just I plus j. And so ci, zi, summed over all I, is just c. And then cj, zj, summed over all j, is c again. So on the right-hand side, I'm going to get c squared. The next term comes with a minus sign, and there's a 2 sitting out in front. And then what is this guy? So now let me return and write this as ck, z to the power k. So I have sum ck, zk, which is just the generating function. So that's g of z, c of z. And then I have summation ci with nothing. But ci with nothing is the same as sum ci z to the k with z set equal to 1. So this is nothing more than c of z equals 1. So here is the dynamical equation that's satisfied by the generating function. So it looks, in some ways, it's really quite spectacular, because we start with an infinite set of equations. We reduced it to one equation. There's only one slight flaw in this problem, which is that we started with an equation for c of z dot. This involves c of z. But here is c of z equals 1. So it looks like it's not closed. But we can now ask, what is the equation for c of 1 itself? So let's just substitute c of 1 in this equation. And I'm going to get c dot of 1 in t. So here I have c of 1 squared minus 2 c of 1 squared. So minus c of 1 all squared. So in principle, we know what c of 1 is, because we can solve this equation. And then we can plug it in here and find c of z. But even easier than all of that, notice that the quantity, let me call this, and so this is the same as my note. So let me define c minus, which depends on z and t. I'll write this, define this as c of z and t minus c of 1 and t. And so if I subtract c of 1 and t, if I now ask, what is c minus dot of z and t? So I have to take this thing and subtract that guy. And so I'm going to get c of z squared minus 2 cc1 plus c of 1 squared, which is nothing more than minus c minus of z and t all squared. So that is my equation. That's all there is to it. So we've reduced the infinite series, infinite sum of master equations to a very simple equation. And so the solution to this is c minus of z and t is equal to c minus at z at t equals 0 divided by 1 minus c minus of z and t equals 0 times t. So again, I'm not showing you how to solve this differential equation. I'm assuming that it's trivial. It's from sophomore differential equations, and you just have to do it. And the thing is that now we have to just put in what is the initial generating function, and then we have the full solution. So if my initial condition is that I start with monomers only, which is a very natural thing. You start when you make Jell-O. You take the powder out, and it's all the same size molecules. Just stick it in. And then that means that my initial condition ck at t equals 0 is equal to delta of k1. And that means that my generating function at t equals 0, which is equal to summation ck zk. And so this just goes into z, because only the k equals 1 term survives. And similarly, c minus at t equals 0 is just c minus c at 1. So this is just equal to z minus 1. So this guy is equal to z minus 1, 1 minus z minus 1, t. And now to find the concentration, we have to expand this in a power series in z, and then extract the nth term in the series. And so let me not do any of those details, because they're entirely straightforward and boring. But let me just tell you what the final result is, because that's the thing which is physically interesting. Ck of t is equal to 1 over 1 plus t all squared times t divided by 1 plus t to the power k minus 1. So that is the result of the cluster mass distribution for the so-called constant kernel or constant reaction rate aggregation. And let's dissect this a little bit to get some physical intuition for what's going on here. So first of all, if I look as a function of time, look at what CK is doing. So if I look for monomers, K equals 1, and this goes away, and I just have 1 over 1 plus T squared. So monomers, maybe make this a little taller, monomers are just doing something like this. So here is K equals 1. Dimers. For k equals 2, at t equals 0, this thing gives me 0. And so this thing, for small time, initially grows linearly with time. But eventually, for large time, then this correction factor is basically just going to a constant. It's going to 1. And I just get 1 over 1 plus t squared. So dimers start off linearly with time. But eventually, they fall off. And they go to a common limit with the monomers. So there's k equals 2. Trimers. C3 will start out quadratically with time, so they do something like this. And so here's k equals 3, and so on down the road. So that's what the mass distribution looks like as a function of time. If I look as a function of mass, I'm sorry, so this is now as a function of mass, ck. Well, let me do a little violence to this to like look at the mass distribution. So the thing is that here I have 1 over, so let's look at the limit. T is going to infinity. So the limit T goes to infinity, here is T to the minus 2 is a common prefactor. When T goes to infinity, this goes to 1 divided by 1 plus 1 over T to the power k minus 1, which is the same as 1 minus T to the power k minus 1, which asymptotically is e to the minus k over T. So asymptotically, the mass distribution is just a simple exponential with a prefactor t to the minus 2. I'll have much more to say about this form of the mass distribution probably next time when I talk about the scaling approach to describing aggregation kinetics. So how are we doing here? Questions? Yes.
How would it change, I mean, just like intuitively, how would this change if you imposed a cutoff on the mass?
So you say that beyond a certain size mass and there was no aggregation to occur?
Basically that it wouldn't be stable past some mass. I mean,
okay.
Then it seems like as you take t to infinity, it eventually have to pile up at that highest mass.
That's correct. That's right. So the thing is that in terms of applications to real physical processes, there's been like 20 to 30 years of work by very high-powered mathematical physicists who have studied this aggregation process with physically motivated reaction rates and things like precipitation or breakup. And so all of this is fairly well mined. And there's a very rich range of phenomenology. I'm just giving you the first little glimpse into this whole world. OK, so what I'd like to do now is very briefly, I think, because is to talk about another exactly soluble case, the so-called product kernel aggregation. So let's now talk about another case in which the reaction rate is something which grows rapidly as the clusters get larger. So the thing is that in the early days of aggregation kinetics, Shmolikovsky himself solved in 1917 this process with constant reaction rate. And then over the past like 90 years or so, people have come up with progressively more and more clever solutions with harder and harder problems that are motivated by physics. And one nice example of this is Kij is equal to I times j. And the motivation for this is think about the problem of Jell-O. So again, Jell-O is made up of multifunctional molecules. So if you have a molecule that looks like this, say three-functional. So when two Jell-O molecules meet, one of the arms here will join with one of the arms here. And when they join, the functionality of the dimer is much bigger than the monomer. And so if I've joined these things together, then I have something which looks like that. So I started with a three-functional unit and became a five-functional unit. If there's another joining going on, then a trimer has even higher functionality. And so typically, in this sort of a process where I think about a molecule which has is made up of arms which are grabby, then as the cluster grows, the amount of arms that are in this object grows linearly with the mass of the object. And so that motivates a product kernel aggregation, because the rate at which two molecules that have n grabby arms are going to meet each other is proportional to the number of arms of one guy times the number of arms of the other guy, and so proportional to the product of the number of arms of each type. So this motivates a so-called product kernel aggregation process. Now, it turns out that the product kernel aggregation is mathematically a real challenge. And I'm just going to try and sketch out some aspects about it, because it's so beautiful that it's worth at least giving you a little flavor of what comes out of this. So let's now try and investigate product kernel aggregation. So if Kij is equal to this, then I'm going to get Ck dot is equal to, so I have a summation over all ij, 1 half ij ci cj minus summation, and then I have ik ci ck. And so this sum goes from I equals 1 to infinity unrestricted. This one is restricted. Now, the thing is that in the second sum, notice that I have the product ICI summed over all I, which is by definition just the total mass of the system, which I'll take to be 1. So we can simplify this a little bit and write this as a summation IJ 1 half, 1 half IJ CI CJ minus KCK, because summation I CI by construction is equal to 1. Yes, please.
In this case, we probably not consider I and J as independent, because if you consider I and J as independent, then you have two of those sum values. So the second thing against J, the third one against I.
No, but the thing is that the point here is that we must have that I plus J is equal to K. That's the crucial point of the restriction, is that the indices I plus J add up to K. So
what I'm saying is the second thing, for instance,
this
K
one
is
here.
Three, yeah. If for instance K is 3, I can be 1 and J is 2. So if I is 1 and J is 2, and summing over I means you are, and taking it by 2, you are taking half of the possibility of J.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. But the thing is that there's, because this sum is unrestricted, that's the first point. And so I can, let me maybe write it this way. I can write this as summation ICI, and then I'm left with KCK outside. So this object by itself is nothing more than the total mass of the system. Over here, because these sums are restricted, the summation ICI, you can't just say it's equal to the total mass of the system, because it's part of the sum, and it's not over all indices freely. So it's restricted in which indices you sum over, because you must have that. Let me make this a little bit bigger. This is summation I plus J is equal to K. So you can't sum freely over all I, because it has to always be that I is equal to K minus J. Anything else? OK. So anyways, let's see. What should I do now? So the first thing about this equation is that as it stands, it's very hard from just looking at this equation to infer anything interesting from it. And so what I want to do, first of all, so let's look at some moment equations, because it turns out that the moment equations bear inside of them already tell you that something really fishy is happening with these equations at a finite time. This system of equations for constant kernel aggregation just had a smoothly varying cluster mass distribution. For product kernel aggregation, something very different happens. At a finite time, there is an explosion, and there's what's called gelation at a finite time, that all of the mass of the system, or a finite fraction of the mass of the system, condenses into an infinite gel molecule. You make jello out of liquid. And that is very, and in order to get a sense of what's going on here, let's look at the moment equations. And in particular, let's look at the second moment, m2 dot. That's the simplest way of seeing that something really weird is going to happen. So we saw over in the case of constant kernel that m2 dot was just proportional to constant, and so the typical mass grew linearly with time. But let's look over here. So M2 dot, so this is a summation, k squared ck dot. So we have to take this equation and multiply by k squared. So we have the summation from k equals 1 to infinity, k squared, and then I have summation restricted, ij, 1 half, ij, ci, cj, and then I have minus k, ck. So let's see what happens here. So I'll write this in the following way. So the point is that now, because in the first summation, when I sum over all k, that means that this sum becomes unrestricted. So this is now becomes unrestricted sum on I and j. And k I'll write as I plus j. So I have I plus j all squared. And then I have ij, ci, cj. And there was a 1 half sitting out in front. So that's the first term. And then I have minus. Here I have, 1 second, k cubed. So I have k cubed, c. So let me write this as summation over all k, k cubed, ck. Yes?
Where did our c I go in the second term? Because before we had a sum over.
Well, no. So this thing generically I'm setting equal to 1 because of the total amount of the system. So it's always, always gonzo. OK. Anyway, so now let's look at what these two terms are. So for example, there's an I squared 2ij plus j squared. So look at the I squared term. So we have I squared times I, which is I cubed. So I'll get I cubed ci, which is a third moment, times jcj, which is just 1. So I'll get third moment. But I get two such terms. So I get third moment squared. So I'm going to get here, I'm going to get m3 squared from the two quadratic terms here. And then I have a cross term because I have 2ij, so that cancels the 2 there. And I get ij. And so that's I times j times I times j. So it's I squared j squared cicj, which is plus m2 squared, and then minus m3. Whoops. I don't have m3 squared here. The quadratic term was, for example, I cubed ci jcj. So the I cubed ci is m3, and the jcj is just m1, which was 1. So this is linear. So anyways, this is nothing more than m2 squared. What is the solution to this differential equation? The solution is m2 is equal to 1 over 1 minus t. So at t equals 1, the second moment blows up. So this is a signal that something very funky is happening at t equals 1. And in fact, it's a signal that gelation is actually occurring. So by the way, Dennis, now when should I stop? Because I started late. So you tell me when I should stop. I'll stop at 12 o'clock. OK. OK. So having seen that there's something weird happening at t equals 1, let's now solve the master equations by the generating function technique. And the thing here is that when we use the generating function technique for the product kernel aggregation, there's some elements to it that I would say when I was first exposed to it struck me as black magic. And so I'm going to try as gently as I can to introduce you to some of this black magic, because it's incredibly powerful and incredibly nice. And you know, I find it just very edifying. So first thing is, let me now define the generating function. And I'm going to call it e as a function of yt. And e because I'm going to write it in terms of exponential. So let me define eyt as a summation over all k from 1 to infinity ck. But instead of calling it z to the power k, I'm going to call it e to the yk. So that's why I use the term exponential. And it's just as a matter of convenience, because the thing is that when you take the generating function and differentiate with respect to z, you bring down a factor z, and then you have z to the power n minus 1. But here, if you differentiate with respect to y, you bring down a factor of k and leave this the same. And so it turns out to be convenient to do it with the exponential. There's one more aspect to this, which is that for reasons that, you know, once you get used to the game of how you play the generating function, you learn sometimes that it's useful to study this generating function rather than the zeroth moment generating function. So let's study the first moment generating function rather than the zeroth moment. So let's take this as a definition. And so let's now write down the master equations. Let's apply this. So let's write now an equation, a dynamical equation for this generating function. So what I have to do then, I have to take my equation, ck dot, so this is equal to summation 1 half ij ci cj minus summation k ck. So I take this equation, and as before, I'm going to sum over all values of k from 1 to infinity and multiply through by k e to the y k. And let's just see what happens. So on the left-hand side of the equation, we get nothing more than e dot. And here it's going to be a little bit, let me be pedantic, and let me really write that as a partial derivative, because ck has two arguments, k and t. And so e has two arguments, y and t. And this means partial differentiation with respect to t. OK. All right, now let's look at the right-hand side. Let's first of all do the easy term. The easy term is over here. We have kck, k e to the yk. So this term is like k squared ck e to the yk summation. And this is nothing more than taking d by dy, a summation kck e to the yk, which is just a generating function. So the minus term here is minus dE by dy. So now let's look at the first term. So for the first term, we have 1 half. And so I have summation ij. But now let's write k as I plus j, I plus j. And then I have e to the yi, e to the yj. So I break up k as just I plus j. And so you see there's going to be two terms which are identical. There's a term which is I squared e to the yi times j e to the yj. And then there's another term which is j squared e to the yj, I e to the yi. So there's two identical terms. So let's just consider a single term. So we're going to just have summation I squared j e to the yi e to the yj. So the j e to the yj, oh, and then this is times, I forgot the ci cj. There was ci cj here, ci cj. So e to the yj times cj is just the generating function. I squared ci e to the yi, which is the first derivative again. So what we're going to get here is e times dE by dy. So there's the equation for the generating function. And we write it in the following way. E sub t. So now I use subscript to denote partial differentiation. And then I'm going to have equals e minus 1 dE by dy. Well, I'm sorry. I want to write this elegantly, ey. So there's my equation for the generating function. Has anybody ever seen this equation before? Suppose I did this, just for the sake of argument. Has anyone seen this equation before? Wave equation? One-dimensional wave equation, where we know the solutions are function of x, a function of y minus t. So this is nothing more than a nonlinear wave equation. And in fact, it goes by the name of the Burgers equation, which maybe some of you heard that terminology somewhere. It's the Burgers equation in disguise. So it's kind of amazing that from the problem of aggregation kinetics out emerges an equation of nonlinear wave propagation, the Burgers equation. And the thing about the Burgers equation is that it's also wave propagation, but the propagation velocity depends on the amplitude. And because different parts of the wave propagate at different speeds, there's a phenomenon of wave breaking at a finite time. And when the wave breaks at a finite time, that corresponds to the gelation phenomenon. Now, here's the part about this presentation which now delves into, the area of black magic. How do we solve these sorts of equations? There's something called the method of characteristics. Has anybody taken a partial differential equations course and heard that terminology? OK. So there is, just suffice it to say that there exists a a well-defined method to solve these sorts of equations. And since I only have 5 minutes left, what I'm going to do now is I'll show you how to solve this equation, and then I'll stop there. So first of all, let's go back to something we know. Et is equal to Ey, right? So you know here that the solution is E is some function of y minus t, where the function is determined by the initial condition. But how can we get that in a more formal way that allows us to solve this equation? Let me write in the following way. Et minus Ey is equal to 0. And I'll write this as dE by dt minus dE by dy is equal to 0. Now I'm going to write this in the following way. I'll write this as dE by dt. I'll say it's equal to that. But dE by dt, so that's equal to dE by dt, dE by dt, plus dE by dy, dy by dt, equals 0. So the point is that on the line dy by dt, so if dy by dt is equal to minus 1, then we just get back this equation. And so the point is that on the line dy by dt is equal to minus 1, we have the total derivative is equal to 0. So on this line, E is equal to a constant. So what it says then is that y minus t, so let me do it this way. So if I look in the yt plane, here is t, here is y. And so I have lines y plus t, you know, the derivative, I mean, the slope is equal to minus 1. So on these lines, E is constant. Here E is equal to E1, here E is equal to E2, here E is equal to E3. And so at t equals 0, the initial condition, if I know what it is here, which is the initial condition, then I can propagate it anywhere along these characteristics. So the thing is that once I know the value of E at some point here, then I know it everywhere else. So basically what I can say is that y minus t is equal to some function of E, which depends on the initial condition. And at t equals 0, I find out what y is. It's the initial condition. And then this is basically, this is the solution. And notice that if I invert this function, I would write, therefore, that E is the inverse function of y minus t, which is just what you learn from sort of elementary wave mechanics, that the solution is just some function of y minus t. So this is a formal way of solving this equation. So the thing is that now for the nonlinear wave equation, I do exactly the same business. So I don't need this, because this is for the linear wave equation. But for the nonlinear wave equation, I just say, well, I just write this equation as a total time derivative. So I'm going to write here, my equation is dE by dt plus 1 minus E dE by dy is equal to 0. So on the locus, dy by dt is equal to 1 minus E. E is a constant. So let me write it this way. So for yt is equal to 1 minus E, E is equal to a constant. Or another way of putting it is that y equals 1 minus E t is equal to. So on this line, E is a constant. And I determine it by the initial condition. So when t is equal to 0, so I can write this. So this is my solution to the problem. So here on this locus, E is a constant. And so the value that it takes depends on the initial condition. So that's it. That's my solution. And the thing is that at t equals 0, I've got now 90 seconds to finish this, so I think I can do it. So at t equals 0, what is this? So we have ck, which is a delta function, times k, e to the yk. This is nothing more than e to the y at t equals 0, because the only term which is non-zero in this, the only surviving term in the sum is k equals 1. So I have c1, which is 1, times 1, times e to the y. So the thing is that at t equals 0, we have y is equal to f of e. But that is equal to But you see here that e is e to the y, so that means that f of e is equal to logarithm of y. So my final solution is that y is equal to 1 minus et plus log y. So there's my solution. I've done this a little bit quickly, so you know but you know I've only got now 15 seconds left. So let me write down the final answer for the generating function. So what I have here finally is that when I exponentiate this guy, I'm going to get that e times e to the minus et is equal to e to the y minus t. That is my answer. So I just exponentiate this, and I get that. Sorry, I've done some stupid mistake here. E to the y, so y is log e. So y, so at t equals 0, y is log e. So this is log e. Sorry, log e. OK. All right, so first of all, this equation, so this is the solution. But the problem is we want to compute the generating function. But notice that we have the generating function mixed up with this exponential. So in some sense, this is an implicit equation for the generating function. What we want to do then is expand the generating function in a power series, in this power series, and extract CK. So we now have two pieces of black magic, which is, first of all, we have to take this implicit relation and make it explicit. And then we have to compute the nth term in the power series representation of that. These two steps involve black magic, to my taste. When I first was exposed to this, I said, this is black magic. So I guess next time I'll begin with black magic, I'll show you how to do that, which involves something called the Lagrange inversion formula. And before I actually break here, let me just ask the question, how many people are familiar and happy with residue calculus, complex variable analysis, and all that stuff? Looks like almost everybody raised their hand.
Yeah, come on, that is.
Okay, because that is going to be like something I need to do this.
Oh, okay, my friend, so pick up your work. group number one. I don't know where I can pull number three yet, but it's a problem of number one. So there are three problems, and the homework is due next Monday.
Yes, question.
The moment problem
is that. Sorry?
The moment we have t equals 1.
Yes.
If my system is in a curvature, I will not.
Well, first of all, this is for an infinite system. So for a finite system, what you'd have is that all the mass, or like a finite fraction of mass, condenses into one big giant drop. Pardon? Well, formation of macroscopic drop. Well, I mean, the thing is that rain is not terribly macroscopic, but think about jello. That's a better example. So that means that, you know, the gel has set and that it's like... Method of characteristics.
Dennis.